This episode was made possible by a grant from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund presented by Dominion Energy, and by a grant from Virginia Humanities.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, and the Potomac quilters are gathered at our usual spot at the Tribal Center.
I think as a culture, we're not delicate people.
That's the best way I know to put it. We're not delicate people.
That's Tracy Williams Foyer. She's one of our members.
So we're not the old lady that you think of in some rich southern town making fancy quilts.
Well, I don't know. My grandma was very soft. Well, in her older years, she was soft-spoken, but I heard she was a little hothead when she was younger.
And that's my sister, Joanne Newton Meredith.
But I bet you if you crossed her, she wasn't delicate.
Oh, no.
No.
For generations, Potomac women of White Oak, Virginia, have been getting together like this to make quilts and to share stories. Most of us grew up here near our ancestral lands on Potomac Creek, about an hour south of Washington, D.C.
Well, Daddy used to tell us that when he was bad, she could run pretty fast out the back door, get a switch off the weeping willow tree, and smack him with it.
Uh-huh. So, oh,
and,
yeah.
And my dad was pretty quick. And she used to wear a thimble on her finger all the time and hit him on top of the head with it.
He probably needed
a thump. He did. I'm Joanne Newton Meredith. I live in Spotsylvania. I kind of left White Oak when I was 18, but close by, you know, Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania.
My sister retired after a career with the Army Corps of Engineers. She's also a talented artist.
And I love to sew. I like the colors. I like to quilt. That's it. And I'm more of an art person than I am a quilter. So, yeah.
I'm Tracy Williams Foyer. I grew up in White Oak. Couldn't wait to get away. Left, went all the way to Georgia. That's when I realized that our culture was very different than the outside culture. And that's when I couldn't wait to get back to White Oak. So I moved back to White Oak in 2009.
Tracy is a Stafford County school bus attendant working with special needs and preschool age children.
I'm Kathy Bullock Harding. I grew up in White Oak, moved next door, have never left, married a cousin. My son is the vice chief.
Kathy is the youngest of 13 children and raised five of her own. She was widowed at 50 and works at a local farm. She's the quietest one of us.
I do what's necessary. I don't quilt to be pretty. I do what's necessary.
It is all pretty.
I'm Jennifer Newton Gallahan. I'm known in my community as Little Pokey. I've lived in White Oak all my life. Our grandmother's name was Grace Pocahontas Newton. Her nickname was Pokey, Aunt Pokey, or Miss Pokey. So that's where the Pokey came from in my name, Little Pokey. When I was little, they said I looked so much like her. She quilted, and so did our mom and our aunts. And like us, they shared our stories.
I had a school bus driver years ago before I ever went to work for transportation tell me that all the school bus drivers wanted the White Oak route, because we still disciplined our kids. And she said, they're not scared of daddy. She said, all you have to do is tell them, I'm telling your mama. And they'll straighten right up that all the White Oak kids are afraid of mama. But they, if you tell them, I'm gonna tell your daddy, they don't care. But mama, these White Oak mamas will get you. I wish I could hand some out. Everybody gets a White Oak grandma.
The quilt we're working on today will be raffled off later this year to fund a scholarship for students from our tribe. Most of us have retired, and it's hard to believe, but we are at a point in life where we are considered the tribal elders. Once a week, we meet upstairs in a 1915 brick farmhouse we leased from Stafford County for our tribal center and museum. Our room is about 12 feet square, most of which is taken up by bookcases packed with fabric and supplies and the long quilting frame. One of our tribal citizens made this for us from my grandmother's 100-year-old quilt frames. And when you say frame, you're talking about these two long pieces right here. And our grandmother, when they would quilt, all the ladies in White Oak would get together and quilt, and more than likely they'd quilt in the kitchen or the living room, and they'd set these frames in a ladder back chair. They didn't have these fancy stands that they put them on. So they would all get together and quilt that way. As we work, we pass along stories about our lives, our tribe, and our culture. Today, we were talking about the power of Indigenous women. You may not know this, but before colonists arrived and tried to wipe us out, we were a matrilineal society. Our women held key leadership and decision-making positions. Women built and repaired the houses and made pottery and clothing. We were the keepers of tribal history, spirituality, and culture, and we cared for the land. We nurtured tribal life, providing food through gardens, caring for and educating the children. We were the glue that held our tribe together. In this episode, you'll learn about the Potomac quilters and how, like the women before us, we carry on our ancestral strength and heritage and pass it on to our children. This is Tribal Truth.
Won't you sing me back home with a song I used to hear?
For some women in our group, like my niece Leslie, quilting has been a way to get through hard times.
I once made two queen-size crocheted quilts. He worked me through a time in my marriage where I didn't wasn't sure we were going to stay together. And he stayed alive and I stayed alive and we're still married 27 years later.
Our history is pieced together. Like when my father was looking into our genealogy, he went to family cemeteries and old home sites and looked at family Bibles. We also rely on interpretations and anecdotes within our tribe. Many of the papers documenting our families were burned with the courthouses during the Civil War. Long before the war, our men were watermen and farmers. With the devastation of war, fishing was particularly important in rebuilding the economy and supporting families within our community. Women grew and canned food, raised children, sewed and quilted. We were poor. We used outhouses and heated modest homes with wood-burning stoves. Quilts were not a hobby, they were a necessity, made heavy to keep families warm. Every quilt's different. This is more of a patchwork quilt, and the old-timey quilts, you would see them tied like this. You know, like our grandmother did, they used all kinds of stuff for batting. They didn't go to the store and buy batting like we do now. They would use old blankets. They would use old clothes. Whatever they had, because then quilting was done out of necessity. It's not like it's done now for decoration. Back then, fabric to make a quilt was also hard to come by. You cut up old clothes. You cut up rags. You shared material. Like, we have quilts that my grandmother, my aunts, my mama made, and they all have a piece of the same material in it because they shared their material. You know, I have this much left over from my blouse. You want it for your quilt? You know, that kind of thing. So they would trade it back and forth. Besides keeping us warm, using old clothes for quilt patches is another way of passing on stories. Today as we sew, you can hear the hum of a heater that keeps our workroom cozy. One of our tribal elders, Donnie Morgan, has quietly slipped in. He sits and listens.
Sometimes when we gather here, we get visitors like Donnie or different fellas will come because a lot of what goes on in the community,
they hear it
from them. They hear, I mean, it's not that we're gossipy, but like who's sick, who died, who's related to who. We had a horrible accident last year and we're all sitting here trying to figure out like, which one it is, because oftentimes we have the same names in the community. That's a common thing. I think we've got, I don't know, at least three or four Alfred Williamses, which was on my side of the family. Mm-hmm. And because we always name our kids after ancestors. Mm-hmm. So then it gets confusing about which one you're talking about. I think that's why we have all these White Oak nicknames.
Somebody asked Donnie what brings him to the tribal center today.
Gossip. No, I'm just kidding. No, I have eggs today for Kathy. I brought eggs from home. But I remember growing up, no heat other than a wood stove. Actually, my grandmother didn't have running water in the house, and we did have an outhouse. And, of course, every now and then you had to move that because it needed to be moved. And I lived with my grandmother probably up until I was four, something like that. And being so cold in that old house, which was built probably early 1800s, and so many quilts on the bed. I was a little fella. I could not get out of the bed. It was so heavy. And having to wrap towels around bricks to keep your feet warm.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But most all of our traditions come from our great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents.
To understand the amount of work that went into making the old quilts, my sister Joanne and I pull out a quilt made by our grandma, Grace Pocahontas Newton. It is a work of love and art. The pattern is called 8-Point Star and was her daughter Velma's wedding quilt. It was all hand-pieced. She cut each diamond shape using sandpaper, newspaper, or grocery bags for the patterns. She sewed each diamond by hand. She hand-quilted it using the finest stitches that had to pierce 3 layers of fabric and that heavy batting we talked about. She developed arthritis and eventually could no longer quilt. It made each of her quilts even more precious. When she passed, her quilts went to Aunt Velma. Then, something horrible happened. Joanne and I almost had this heritage taken away.
Is this the one you had to buy back?
Yes.
Because I'll tell you what happened. When my aunt, Velma, passed away, and of course her husband got all her belongings, when he passed away, he had an executor. He made us buy back anything we wanted from the house. This went to public auction. And her and I sat on the computer until, 10 or 11 o'clock that night to make sure we got those quilts back. We paid $1,000 a piece for 3 quilts. And went back to the estate, so then we got it back.
We got it back.
Yep, but he wouldn't give it to us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
This story of nearly losing ownership of our heritage is not an unfamiliar one. It's part of centuries of Europeans trying to get rid of our people and our cultures.
Colonialism, the whole point is to erase people who are here already. It's a whole lot easier to take land and resources when you create this idea that it was empty to start with. And continually reinforce that idea through centuries of legislation.
Brad Hatch is a tribal council member and an archaeologist.
You know, if you look at what's taught in schools today, I think people still don't know a lot about Virginia Indians, even though I think we're more visible now than we have been in a very long time. I think the general public tends to be poorly educated on, you know, the fact that, first of all, we're still here, and second of all, that we're a very diverse group of people.
It's pretty awful when people deny your existence, and it happens to Indigenous people quite a lot. Just recently, Kathy and I experienced that erasure firsthand at a lecture by Rappahannock Chief Ann Richardson during the question and answer session.
I've read a lot recently about the Nanzatico and the Potawatomi and the Portobello and over some of the history there. And the Rappahannock seem to have been able to survive where those other tribes were completely eradicated.
It may be hard to hear, but an audience member said our tribe was completely eradicated. But Chief Ann, she sets her straight.
Well, first of all, the Potawatomi are still alive and kicking up in Stafford County, and they have a museum. Hi, I'm glad you guys came. They have a museum up there on Route 3 that is absolutely beautiful. I encourage you to go and visit them. I'm good friends with their chief. I love him, and their people have been interacting with my people and marrying with my people for probably hundreds and thousands of years.
It's unfortunate that even today people don't believe we exist. As Brad said, the colonists tried to erase us. But as Chief Ann said, some of us were absorbed into her tribe and others, like the Rappahannocks, we hid in plain sight. legislation like Jim Crow laws mandated racial segregation for 75 years, beginning in the 1890s. One of the darkest times for tribes in Virginia was what some of us call the Reign of Terror or paper genocide. Virginia enacted the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which began the campaign to once again erase us by removing indigenous people from the State Bureau of Vital Statistics. Women could not declare their child's tribal affiliation on a birth certificate and were forced to write colored. Some of us in our tribe who had married Europeans were able to pass as white. Even in their own homes, many of our ancestors were guarded about their indigenous heritage for fear of going to jail.
Terrible to say, but it's the truth. Everybody in White Oak, you know, the joke is we don't have a family tree, we have a family stump, because
family,
yeah, everybody intermarried, and that was the thing to keep the Indian blood, is what all the old timers said.
Caleb Dodd is an 18-year-old tribal citizen. He tells us stories like he's an elder. He's a talented musician. In between playing, he tells his family history.
Everybody started to say, no, we're not Indian. My great-grandfather was born in 1924, which was a year past. My great-great-grandmother Fanny would say, don't say that, don't say that. They weren't around here. They're not in our blood. No, we don't have any of that, because I had to hide it from people.
One way to understand what happened to indigenous women is the story of Pocahontas. It's a complicated one, first twisted by colonists, and continues to be misunderstood today. What we know is she was the daughter of Wahoon Seneca, the paramount chief of the Powhatan Confederacy of 30-plus tribes, including ours. She was married to a member of our tribe until she was kidnapped, put on a ship, and confined by the British at Jamestown. Her arranged marriage to colonist John Rolfe put an end to the First Anglo-Powhatan War. She had a child with him. Later, Rolfe took her to England, where she died under mysterious circumstances, just as she was on a ship home. She was buried in England. The colonist version of the story put my tribe at the center of the plot to kidnap Pocahontas. We grew up with this story. In it, the chief's brother and his wife plotted with the British to kidnap Pocahontas. His name was Jopasis, also known as Japazaw. He was the chief of one of our towns called Passpatansy and brother to the chief of the Potomac tribe. Today, we're changing that narrative. In our museum downstairs at the Tribal Center, we display a 1624 European engraving, a rendition of this betrayal. Japazaw is depicted as a devil wearing a tail, feathers on either side of his head like horns, and a pointed beard. Behind him, British soldiers are burning down one of our villages. To us, it's obvious we were forced to hand over Pocahontas. What happened to Pocahontas hits a nerve with Joanne.
It just makes sense that she was taken, stolen, raped, and held against her will. Forever. I think her sister was over there, wasn't she? And she was okay. They got on the ship. The next day she died. So they think she was murdered.
Yeah.
But as a woman, I know what we go through now, mm-hmm. and what they probably went through back then was horrendous. Mm-hmm. You had no say. You had no say in nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing at all. So.
But women did have a say in just about everything before colonists made our cultures and traditions illegal. In fact, they were quite powerful among the eastern woodland communities up and down the Atlantic coast. To learn more about this, we meet with Diana Gates, a citizen of the Chironaka Nottoway tribe, who has done a great deal of research on the history of indigenous women. We meet her at an exhibit on indigenous perspectives at the Library of Virginia in Richmond. Diana is a policy researcher with several degrees and in a Doctor of Social Work program. She's also a single mother of two small children.
I sleep sometimes.
As she talks, Diana uses an unfamiliar term, matrifocal.
So women, mothers in particular, grandmothers, were the focal point of families. You'll see that largely women were heads of households. They controlled the agriculture within the community. So upwards of 60 to 70% of a community's diet came from women's efforts in agriculture.
Women also held political leadership roles, and some were warriors. And there's more. Indigenous women were allowed extramarital liaisons and divorce.
A lot of the early English settlers wrote about these, so William Strachey in particular is one. These settlers were not anthropologists, so the science of anthropology hadn't been created yet, and the early settlers were not objective social science researchers.
Colonizers came from a patriarchal society where men controlled the home and land, and women were the property of their husbands. Now they saw a tribal culture that was completely opposite.
Everyone was pretty much free to behave how they wanted, as long as it wasn't to the detriment to other people, to their land, to communal living. So there was just a lot more freedom that these European settlers had a hard time wrapping their heads around.
But all that power became a target for colonizers who forcibly inserted their culture.
A lot of the thinking is around civilizing and Christianizing the Indian savages. And, you know, from our perspective, we're thinking, hey, these guys don't even bathe regularly. Why are they thinking they're going to civilize us? Y'all stink. You know, like, what do you mean civilizing? We have civilizations here that are mutually beneficial for everyone. It's based on communal leadership. It's egalitarian. And you come to civilize us?
But from that European, Christian, male-dominated perspective, tribes whose men had more than one wife and women who were allowed extramarital liaisons and divorce lined up with the colonial view of us as savages. So they targeted indigenous women's power.
We still had women chiefs. We had women in political leadership throughout the mid-1800s. And then it really dwindles. And there seems to be a big shift between the mid-1800s to even, you know, the 1980s. We're seeing shifts in women in political leadership. So there is this big time period where women are not able to access political leadership.
As with Pocahontas, marriage is weaponized by colonists. During the 17th century, colonies began to require marriage licenses.
There was a shift to needing to have your marriage confirmed in writing by a court. You see that from that point on, it's very difficult for women to initiate divorce, and marriages are also seen as advantageous for early English settlers because they have access to land. The base point of colonization is ownership of land, and so that is an extreme driver of the intentions for early English settlers to marry or want to marry Virginia Indian women. We had always inherited land because we inherited it from our mothers because they were the ones who owned land, owned the household.
Colonists began to erode ancestral land rights of indigenous women.
So you see that only men can hold land. So then women have to become married to be able to retain the land that their families have always lived on. So it forces Virginia Indian women into these Christianized marriages documented in a court of law so that they would be able to retain ownership of their family's land. You know, that's when you see that slow creep in of these principles to within our communities. They also start to take root within our communities, which is unfortunate.
Today, tribes have influential women chiefs. Indigenous women are assistant chiefs and have seats on tribal council in tribes throughout Virginia.
I just think it's so powerful to make that connection that our continuity of communal and family leadership is now the reason why we are coming out in droves for political leadership. That to me is rematriation, and that's something I'm incredibly proud of for our communities here.
I think of our quilts and how they're also a powerful way women pass on history. Diana agrees.
We also see some tribes like the Potomac tribe and the Saponi tribe where quilting is a big piece of their community's history, and it's a big piece similar to the kitchen table where it encourages folks to sit around a communal table. The transference of knowledge of how to quilt, talking about funny stories from our family's histories, and you know what your great uncle used to do, you know, those types of really fun stories. They all come out around the kitchen table or the quilting table. It's a great chance for grandmothers to sit with their daughters and their granddaughters.
Men in our tribe, like Donnie Morgan, you heard from him earlier, like to sit with us.
I know there are men that participate in quilting, and I think younger men in particular are understanding that this is where all of the good stuff is getting passed down. This is where you hear all the good stuff, because that family lore is just as important, even more important than uncovering a historical account that an English settler wrote.
Diana says her son, at 3, often sits with his father, who is Saponi, while he quilts with his tribe.
He's hearing those stories. It's important for young boys to see their fathers or other men in their community demonstrating their deference to women's teaching. And I'm proud that my son is learning that women's knowledge has not been privileged over the last couple of centuries, but it's equally as important in the framework of our communities.
My father was a commercial fisherman, so the eel pots and all that is part of my heritage. He was on the Potomac at the creek, as we called it.
That's Kathy Bullock Harding, our quiet quilter. Her father taught her how to weigh the fish he caught because he didn't trust anyone. We all have a connection to the water. Potomac Creek is where our tribe once lived and traded. In the Algonquin language, Potomac means to bring again, they go and come. Or more directly, Trading Center. Today I'm with my sister Joanne, Brad Hatch, and Reagan Anderson. At 30, Reagan is the youngest member of our quilting group. We're out on our first kayaking trip of the year, and it's gorgeous. Kathy is with her family on a motorboat. She zooms past us, out toward the Potomac River, a huge smile on her face. She's at peace, the same peace we each feel when we're here. As we paddle, Brad paints the scene.
Right now, we're kind of facing out towards the mouth of the creek where it joins the Potomac River. And on the left side, we've got what's called Indian Point or Marlboro Point. And that's the location of the village that John Smith came to in 1608 and encountered our people. But before that, there was a village there as early as the 1300s that our people have lived in, and then across the Potomac Creek is Passpatanzi, which is the location of another village that was there, at least during the English colonial period, up until about the middle of the 17th century.
Some of our ancestral lands are now part of Crow's Nest Natural Area Preserve.
To our left directly is Crow's Nest, which has several archaeological sites that show the persistence of the Potomac Indian people on the landscape here. And then to our right, we have Belle Plaine's Boat Landing, which is the place where a lot of our tribal fishermen put their boats out in the sort of the late 19th, 20th century, and they still fish out of that area today.
Like me, some in our tribe still own properties close to our ancestral lands near the creek. Reagan lives near Passpatanzi.
I'm Reagan Anderson. I'm a citizen of the Potomac Tribe, and I'm a preservationist and archaeologist.
And she's been the Tribal Historic Preservation Intern for the Virginia Department of Historic Resources.
You know, my grandpa, he knows of the whole don't say you're an Indian kind of thing. His family didn't really hide it. They didn't really care to hide it or to say if they were. They were always kind of nonchalant, and my grandpa is still kind of nonchalant about it.
Reagan and Brad have brought back our tribal tradition of making eel pots.
So fishing has always been a really big part of my family. Getting into the eel pots was, you know, kind of just like I brought my ancestors with me doing that, so.
The creek here is the center of our community and has been for a very long time. I know a lot of people think of like community centers being, you know, land-based, but I think both our way of life and the way we look at the world is very water-based, and it's right here on Potomac Creek.
Unfortunately, Potomac Creek is one of the most unhealthy bodies of water in this area.
We have a tribal tradition of making eel pots, and I was out here last week and caught an eel in one of my eel pots. But you can't eat that eel because they're so full of PCBs that you're not supposed to eat them.
Afterwards, we cook hot dogs on a campfire at our tiny property at Belle Plains. Then some of the younger men in our tribe arrive and, just as their ancestors, pile into a boat and head out to fish. We have cookouts. We have campouts. We camp at least once or twice a year. We've had weddings here. We've had wakes. We've had funerals. When mother died, unbeknownst to us, all of her grandchildren came down here. And that's where they celebrated her. It was right there on that water.
Mm-hmm. We did the same when Daddy died, too.
Mm-hmm. Our father struggled to keep this little piece of property, a quarter of an acre. People tried to squat on it and steal it, and county taxes skyrocketed. Today, we have to turn people away who try to put their boats in here. That's why we're keeping an eye on development, to be sure it doesn't encroach on our heritage. This is the power of place. Tracy said it best while we were quilting.
So the bottom line is, 400 years later, they're still fighting for their land.
Yeah.
There are still people trying to take the land 400 years later.
A quarter of an acre.
Uh-huh.
I let ambition rule me like a hunger.
Songs performed by Caleb Dodd of the Potomac Indian Tribe are It's a Long, Long Way to the Top of the World, written by Don Wayne. Sing Me Back Home, written by Merle Haggard. Indian Flute was performed by Ruby Harding of the Potomac Indian Tribe. Tribal Truth is reported, written, and sound designed by Pamela D'Angelo. Kelly Libby is editor. Additional editing by David Seidel, Jennifer Newton, Little Pokey Gallahan, and Brad Hatch. Support is provided by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund, presented by Dominion Energy, and Virginia Humanities. Additional support is by Radio IQ. Other music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. If you want to learn more about the Potomacs, visit radioiq.org.
It's a long, long way to the top of the world on a rough road that winds round and round. It's a long, long way to the top of the world, but it's only a shortfall back down.